This is episode number 791 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to talk about the Judas Contract, Marvel's Kindle sale, and our favorite Kirby creations. Our comics this week will be Captain America number 25, Batman number 28, and Future Quest Presents Space Ghost number 1. And of course, our Summer of Dread continues this week with the Judge Dredd Tales, The Killer Car Saga, and Oxygen Board.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you!
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
Seconds to comply.
Good, clean, wholesome fun.
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letenry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful, the early bird.
Oh, yeah.
Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
I am doing really good. You got up early to get that worm and...
Yeah, if you don't follow me on Twitter, I was posting that the show is going to be a day late because as you are listening to this, you are hopefully listening to it on the same day that it was recorded, which is Saturday. So usually you put the show out on Friday. I ended up having to work late on Thursday, so we could not record. And so we are recording on a Saturday morning. So when you hear, you might hear people up and about upstairs in the kitchen making their breakfast.
And cranky.
You might hear some lawns being mowed in the background. Although, if you're mowing your lawn today, you're going to be out there bundled up because I don't know if I've told this story on the show before, but my dog knows the days that I'm off. And so he will come in to my bedroom usually starting at like 5:30 in the morning, and I can get him to leave me alone until maybe 6:30. Today he started at 4:30.
Wow.
And he kept coming in. And so usually by 6:30, I will jump out of bed, I will throw my sneakers on, and I will take him for his morning walk. And he loves it because there's nobody out, and we just walk around the neighborhood and all that kind of stuff. Well, this morning it was 39 degrees.
Yep.
And we joked a couple weeks ago about it feeling like fall. This was like a winter morning.
Yes, it is.
39 degrees this morning when we were out walking about a beautiful, crisp, awesome morning. I mean, this is – ultimately, this is my type of weather.
This is what New England's all about.
So I love this kind of weather, but I was not prepared for that drastic of a drop in temperature this morning. So I did that. Just dropped my daughter off at her cheerleading practice for the morning. And here I am to talk with you, Matthew, about the Judas Contract.
My favorite Teen Titans story.
Marv Wolfman and George Perez's classic 1980s-era Teen Titans storyline is getting a deluxe hardcover collection. The new Teen Titans The Judas Contract Deluxe Edition hardcover collects the definitive storyline in Wolfman and Perez's Teen Titans run, which also features art from Romeo Tangal, Dick Giordano, Mike DiCarlo, and Adrian Roy. The 200-page full-color hardcover will be in stores January 31st of 2018, for $29.99, Matthew.
That is a great price.
It's a great price, right? The story begins with the retirement of Robin and Kid Flash and describes the capture of the Teen Titans after one of their own betrays them. Along the way, readers are introduced to Jericho, and Nightwing becomes a major player in the DCU. The storyline was originally published in Tales of Teen Titans number 42-44 and Tales of Teen Titans Annual number 3 in 1984. So I knew that was one of your favorite stories of all time, so I decided to bring that news story for this week. But that's pretty cool. And as you said, it feels to me like $29.99 for a deluxe edition of a beloved storyline. I feel pretty good about that.
Yeah, you could easily go dig through the you know, back issue bins and find it for probably $15. But you're going to get these things hardcover, deluxe, coloring, all the good stuff, probably a bunch of sketches.
I would imagine so. I mean, it's 200 pages. Yeah. So you figure there's going to be, I would suspect, maybe an interview or two in there, a behind-the-scenes sort of thing. Like, it to me, it's like the DVD commentary stuff. If you are a fan of a particular storyline, then being able to get it in a deluxe edition, which to me, that's what print is sort of becoming for me. It certainly is that way for books for me now. Like, I read a lot of books on Kindle. I read a lot of stuff digitally. But if it's a storyline I really love or a book I really love, then I am all about getting that hard copy, especially if it's like a special edition.
Yeah. And the Judas Contract is a story that has lost a lot of its surprise element. It's like The Crying Game when that movie first came out, when you were shocked when you saw it. But then after
or
a while –
Or for you 80s horror fans, Sleepaway Camp.
You know what? On the same lines as The Crying Game. So they've already made a couple movies about it. I think they just did one a couple months ago, which
wasn't
bad. Or
The Dream Ending of Dallas.
Yes.
You know?
Yep.
That kind of stuff. Or the Game of Thrones season finale that just happened, which I don't know anything about because I've never watched an episode of Game of Thrones.
Hashtag Game of Thrones.
Hashtag Game of Thrones season 7.
But when that story happened, because it's all about a betrayal, and when it happened, it was a complete shock because there were a few characters that were introduced leading into this, maybe 7, 8, 9 issues before, and you kind of are always questioning one of them. And it ended up not being the one that you thought. And it was a great story. It was, like you said, it was Robin and Kid Flash retiring. And Kid Flash, I believe, had to because the speed was starting to kill him.
Yep.
And Robin just didn't want to be Robin anymore. So that was when Nightwing was introduced. It's a great, great, great story. And I'm pretty sure Marv Wolfman's going to have a lot to say about that story in that because
That would be a great discussion question. Your favorite betrayal.
There's been a lot.
Whether it be in a comic storyline, whether it be in a movie, whether it be in a TV show, your favorite betrayal. If anybody has one off the top of their head, send us, hit us up on the Facebook page or send us an email about your favorite betrayal in a storyline.
I was going to say, yeah, we have to specify because we don't want to hear about, you know.
No, we don't want to hear about your high school sweetheart or, you know, something horrible that has recently happened in your life. Exactly. But, yeah, I think that's a good one because I immediately was thinking of the television show Angel, but that would be a good discussion question. So if you have one, if you have a favorite betrayal in a storyline, because I do think that twists like that make for these memorable storyline. Whenever a story really surprises you, that is one of those things that kind of elevates it to a classic status, you know, where like, you know, it kind of sticks in your mind forever. So that is coming in January of 2018. Now, right now, as you listen to the show, you can go to Amazon.com, Matthew, or you can go to Comixology.com because there is a huge sale that Marvel is having on all of their titles, including stuff that was released up to the 31st of August. So even newer issues, up to 50% off of thousands of single-issue comics and graphic novels. The sale is running. It's their Labor Day event that they're doing through Comixology and through Amazon. The sale is running from yesterday, Friday, September 1st, through Thursday, September 7th. It says does not include titles released after 8/31/17. So that implies that you might be able to get a substantial discount on what are some very recent releases from Marvel if you want to pick them up digitally. So I would go and look for trades or collections that you have wanted to read at least digitally and pick those up. So up to 50% off, that's a pretty good sale. And that there was a couple articles I read about this that were sort of implying that maybe Marvel is starting to think differently about digital because one of the big complaints that we've had about digital, especially from the big two, is that the price points often stay the same as they are for print. And obviously that is believed to be a way to not upset your retailers that are out there selling the print versions for, you know, cover price. But maybe they're starting to realize that in order to really get people on board with digital, you need to offer a discounted price point.
Yeah, and I think Marvel also is probably looking at some goodwill because they haven't had any in the last couple of years. They've kind of been under fire from the fans. This might be a little bit of a way because I'm thinking, you know, Captain America 25, which I'll talk about, is a very pivotal book. That would be in that 50% off, as well as Secret Empire number 10 would also be in there. So that's, you know, it's a good way to say, hey, I know you. We know you stayed away because you were angry. So why don't you come back and take a look at it at 50% off?
Now, I haven't read any of Secret Empire at all.
Yeah.
In fact, I haven't even really read other than a Spidey issue, and I think I picked up the first or second issue of Secret Warriors, maybe? Haven't followed that at all. You have been reading Secret Empire.
I didn't get the last couple issues, though, and it was mostly because I just was – once everybody started to announce, you know, oh, Marvel's going to be completely new and different, I honestly – said, okay, I'm going to start saving my money.
I mean,
now.
I've read all the spoilers about how it ends, and it ends basically exactly like you would expect it to end, even though Marvel said that it would not end that way. But I was just interested to see what you thought about that. So this is the wrong show to come to if you're looking for Secret Empire news.
Yeah, however, we will talk about it in issue
25.
Oh, you're
going to talk about Captain America, but we have not been following the main event as closely as many other people would have. So yeah, I'm ready to be done with that. And I think that's indicative of kind of most of the big crossover Marvel events of the past few years. It's just they haven't been that interesting, you know, overall. So yeah. So that's that. One last thing I wanted to mention, though, because we just passed Jack Kirby's 100th birthday. There have been a million articles, and I'm sure entire podcast episodes dedicated to who's your favorite Jack Kirby creations, what was your favorite contribution of his, you know, what's your favorite work of his, that kind of stuff. So just briefly, Matthew, as when you hear Jack Kirby and you think of characters that he either completely created himself or co-created with other people, what off the top of your head do you think of as your favorite Jack Kirby creation?
See, it's a very loaded question. It would be like me asking you, name your favorite Megadeth song.
Ooh, that is a very loaded question.
Because I am – Jack Kirby is my 1A to Joe Kubert. Joe Kubert's my number one creator of all time, and Kirby is 1A. The biggest things in my comic book life have all sort of revolved around Jack Kirby. So, of course, I'm going to have to say co-created Captain America with Joe Simon.
Yep.
So that would be obviously the number one. Then for other things, I'm going to have to really kind of dig into a couple of really weird pockets. You got Commandy. You have
– that would have been my – well, actually, no. I knew Captain America, but I would have guessed Commandy would be right
Commandy
up there.
Commandy would be there. The New Gods would be there. And then I'm going to have to go off the board completely.
Uh-huh.
And say Thundar the Barbarian.
Oh, very
because
nice.
That to me was a living Jack Kirby comic book.
It totally was.
So I would definitely go with those. And I don't know, I don't think he had anything to do with Space Ghost. That was Alex Toth. But yeah, there's just so much stuff. But I would definitely say for creations, those were them.
Do you think of him more as a Marvel or DC? In terms of your fandom of his stuff, like are you a fan of more of his characters that he did for Marvel or DC?
That's a great, great question because I always think of him as Marvel.
Uh-huh.
I have a hard time associating him with DC, but some of my favorite work he did, Commandy was DC, The New Gods was DC.
Right.
But then you got to turn around and look at what he did in Marvel. There would have been no Thor, there would have been no Captain America, Fantastic Four. I mean,
right, Marvel as we know it.
Yeah,
and you just segued into my favorite of the creations that he was involved with, which is the Fantastic Four and Doctor Doom, which I will throw in there as well. But which I think he appeared in like issue number 5 of Fantastic Four. That to me, and the Fantastic Four was basically a response to the Justice League. But to me, the Fantastic Four is the first family of comics. You know what I mean? And it's. I don't know if they announced that out of Generations or whatever Marvel's doing now with Legacy, that kind of stuff, if there's going to be a Fantastic Four book or not.
I thought I heard that there was.
You know, obviously with the whole movie fiasco, they've treated the Fantastic Four horribly over the past several years. But to me, when I think of Marvel, I think of Spider-Man and I think of the Fantastic Four. Like I am continuously baffled, much like when prior to the Wonder Woman movie, it felt like, you know, Wonder Woman and even Superman to another degree were not being promoted as much as Batman as an important – as the trinity of DC Comics and the two of the most important characters. When I think of Marvel, I think of – I don't think of the Avengers. I think of Spider-Man and I think of the Fantastic Four. Like to me, it is unbelievable.
Those were the first two.
The Fantastic Four are not – the flagship, they're a family.
Yeah.
It just blows me away. Yes, that is my favorite. And that actually sparked a discussion that you and I were having about, you know, as we head down the home stretch of Secret Identity, we're going to be, you know, we have, as this stands, we have 9 episodes left, but we're still finishing up our summer reading and watching projects. I think as we finish those up, we're going to take the remaining handful of shows and probably look back at some of our favorite characters and some of our favorite storylines in the books that we bring to the show. So it's kind of, I think, going to have sort of an out of the long box feel to it. And we might do some themes within that and stuff like that. But thinking about this and thinking about the Fantastic Four really got me thinking about like, I probably want to talk about the Fantastic Four again before we wrap up secret identity. So yeah, but certainly we would love to hear your favorite Kirby creations as well, because I'm sure it's different for everyone.
And on lines with that, I was able to post through our good friend John Cimino sent me the panel that I did with Roy Thomas.
Oh, yes.
Where we talked about Jack Kirby, and I put that up on my Facebook page. I usually don't watch or listen to anything that I do because I will fault it and be embarrassed and think I'm terrible, and the insecurities are all over the place. I watched that and thought, wow, that really came out pretty good.
You know what? I will put that up on our secretidentitypodcast.com site as well. So we'll embed that in a post there so people can check that out too. So if you haven't seen that, you should totally go and watch that immediately.
A lot of fun.
All right, Matthew. I think that's it for our news this week.
I think so.
Before we talk about comics, I think it's important for us to talk about facial hair.
The winter is coming, and this is when you need to protect
it. I'm telling you right now, my Viking oils will be keeping my beard safe and happy now that the fall and soon to be winter, it seems like chill, is setting in around here because, yeah, that's when my skin gets super dry. In fact, I'm already sort of dealing with that where my skin gets super dry as soon as the air gets dry. And the Viking oils is super helpful in making sure that I don't have beard dandruff all over the place for the next 6 to 8 months. So, yeah, VikingOilsLLC.com is the site that you want to go to for your facial hair care products. And, of course, as we are entering into fall, we can expect some new varieties of product because they sort of change with the season. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, very good. Looking forward to it. I've still been using it even though I don't have much on there anymore. And it's just getting me ready because when the winter comes, I will start growing it a little bit more.
We're looking forward to that.
Yes.
When Matt goes grizzly. Okay, so let's get into comic books. And I mentioned that we're not like super into the whole Secret Empire stuff, but you do still pick up Captain America every time it comes out. And obviously, he is the central figure in the Secret Empire storyline. Although, this is still the Sam Wilson Captain America, correct?
Well, this is interesting because when I read the last Captain America, The last Steve Rogers Captain America, it said continued in Captain America 25.
Okay.
So 24 was technically the last Sam Wilson Captain America. So now we're going to only be back to one book.
Okay.
And I don't know if they're doing legacy. I'm assuming they're going to do legacy numbers on this one. So I'm not 100% sure. But I just wanted to pick this one up because I wanted to see what was going on. I wanted to see how this whole thing played out with Falcon. And although this is not – it's a great story, but it certainly isn't very pivotal to everything going on.
Hmm.
They're doing that in Secret Empire. But Nick Spencer is the writer, and then Jesus Saez, and let's see. So he is the artist, Joe Palmatel and Joe Bennett. So those are the other guys there. And the colorist is Rachel Rosenberg. Showing you, Brian, very early in the morning this color scheme to try to read white on red, white, and blue is a little rough. That is the oldest in you and I. So we start out, let me see if we start out. So we start out Painted Desert, Nevada, and you have the IA Tony Stark with, and the IA Tony Stark I've really come to love because he's got the old school Iron Man armor. And then his head is just a big floating blue artificial intelligent looking thing.
So he's the
around.
AI Tony Stark.
AI Tony Stark.
Although I like the IA because that's like
IA,
internal
is that
affairs.
What I said?
Tony
yeah.
Stark. Yeah,
AI,
he's internal affairs.
Yeah, yeah. So he is there and he's got a birthday cake and he's looking at it and he blows out the candle and then he zaps it and starts eating it and he goes, amazing. And now you turn the page and you've got Steve Rogers in his full Hydra regalia meeting the press and talking to everybody. And the first thing he says is war. And he starts to explain how Hydra never wanted this to happen. This is not the way Hydra runs. Full of crap, because that's exactly how you want it to go. And that's exactly what Hydra's built for. It is so funny because you read this and it is a lot like Hitler. I've been watching a lot of stuff on the History Channel about the rise of the Nazis and things like that. And there's a couple things that I was watching where, you know, Hitler was saying, you know, hey, I didn't want to invade Poland, but they forced our hand. Yeah, no, they didn't. They, you know, you're seeing all the justifications, and this is where they're looking to go into Wakanda and take over.
Yep.
So he's talking about how, you know, we're trying to be peaceful. We're trying to create a unified world, and the only holdout right now is Wakanda. Wakanda does not want to join us. They don't want to be a part of us. And he's showing these skylines and saying, you know, for years – All they have done is said, oh, we're just this little basic jungle community. And all of a sudden, you know, he's blasting everything that as Captain America he held. The fact that, you know what, Wakanda's got some of the most important things in the world of superheroes, as well as the war, just what they create. And he's now bringing it public. Oh, yeah, by the way, they create all this, all these metals that we use for things like, you know, war, you know, for shields and things like that. And I think that they need to be a part of this. So he's talking about how they're being aggressive and defiant. And he goes and he's going on his little speech and then says, so this is what it's going to be until they are punished. We need to take care of this. And he says, this is not what we wanted, but this is what we're going to get. Hail Hydra. And then we go to New Tyon. Now, New Tyon is, I believe, where the Inhumans are living. I think that's where
they are. I don't
even
know, to be honest with you.
So
I thought they were living in the – are you talking about New Atalan?
No, this is Titan. Tyon,
oh, okay.
T-I-A-N. Because there's some Inhumans. Oh, well, the Beast is in there. So, or the Mutants. I'm sorry. This is where the Mutants are.
Okay.
So you've got some heroes there that are fighting. There's a battle going on right now. And they're going in going, oh, my gosh, they're storming the palace. They're storming the palace. And you see Beast is there. You see all sorts of villains. There's a big fight going on. And it looks like this is where Madame Hydra is there, or Viper. So you're seeing that Hydra is now getting into the mutant homeland. And all of a sudden, Emma shows up. And Emma is talking about, you know, this is where this ends. This ends right now. The Beast is like, what are you doing? And he goes, well, you wanted to see how this would be. You wanted to see how this was going to play out. And then she's also got a couple Hydra guys right there, and she's screaming at them, much like Cap was yelling at us. And she says, you know what? You can take my offer right now and leave with your lives, or you're going to be destroyed because no mutant will kneel. And now we go to Wakanda, where the battle is going crazy. You've got Hydra soldiers being shot at, and Wakanda is pulling out some crazy-looking weapons. I'll show you, Brian, because it's very Lovecraftian with his tentacle-y kind of look. You've got sorts of stuff going on. And there's somebody in there, and he's on his throne, the Black Panther, and he's saying, let's finish this, let's defend, and get these guys out of here. And all of a sudden, somebody who is reading on a computer screen, but it's sort of like a rock in front of him, he's like, we can't do this, King. He goes, what do you mean we can't deploy him? And he goes, well, we can't. And then you turn around and you see that Baron Zemo and Dr. Faustus have now entered the chambers of Black Panther. And Baron Zemo puts a sword right to his neck and plops him down on the floor. And he's telling him right now, he goes, you know, you're a dead man if you do not tell these people that they need to surrender right now. And he's there and he's like, so all we want to know is where the fragment is. Because they're looking for that final fragment. This is what it's kind of come down to, is everybody, they've hidden fragments of the Cosmic Cube everywhere. Steve Rogers needs that piece of the Cosmic Cube. There's one piece that is missing because Namor gave his up for sake of safety in Atlantis. Nobody's giving it up. And then you have everybody talking about how this is where it's getting really desperate. You turn the page and there is Falcon, who is now back with Tony Stark and the rest of the Avengers. And he's saying, you know, when I was given the mantle of Captain America, I didn't know what to do because I knew people would be looking at me as a leader, as the guy that could just jump right into things. And I struggled, and there's no way that I could have done it without you guys. And he's kind of pumping up the Avengers and telling them, you know, if it wasn't for you, this never would have been able to happen. Our world would have been buried right away if you guys did not rally. So don't look at me as a symbol. It's you guys. And he says, there needs to be justice. We've still got some fight left. So who wants to be Avengers? And then everybody rallies behind him, including your friend Ben Grimm, who is there. And they all start to get ready to go attack. And then they break into a Hydra base. They start taking out Hydra dudes. They're knocking everybody down. It is three or four pages of awesome stuff. And they go in, and it's a Hydra prison, by the way. So they're in there. And this is pretty funny because I completely forgot about this dude. Remember in the very first issue of Secret Empire, the dude who threw up the Captain America lunchbox?
Yeah, I remember you telling me that. Yeah.
So they get there and they go to the prison and they see this guy and he comes out and he's like, my name's Brian McAllister and, you know, everybody here calls me Barf. And they're like, why do they call you Barf? And he goes, because I can throw up anything. You tell me something, I can throw it up. And they're like, oh, yeah, well, you're the guy we're looking for because we want you to barf up a piece of the cosmic cube.
Okay.
So he is going to barf up a piece of the cosmic cube. And the funniest thing is that you see the artificial intelligent Tony Rogers and Sam Wilson looking at him like, oh, my God, this is the grossest thing we ever saw. And then you see in his hands there is a shard of the cosmic cube that he just threw up.
So he just pulled it from wherever it was and threw it up.
Yep. So well, it's not the real one. It's not a real piece. He can make things out of, like, if he thinks about, that's like his mutant power. He's almost like a 3D.
So it's basically a fake piece of the
cosmic
cube.
It's like a 3D printer.
Okay. So all right. I like that.
What they want to do is they are going to give up that piece of the cosmic cube.
As if it were the real one.
And then hopefully it is going to create this incredible disaster because you now – it's like jamming that puzzle piece in that doesn't fit.
Sure.
You can tell everybody you finished the puzzle, but you didn't.
Correct.
So they're there 24 hours later saying, okay, well, we got this and we are going to do this. And they're talking about all the crappy things that have gone on during the battle as they're getting it to get – they're bringing it over. So you see in Atlantis, Namor is dreading and upset at the decision that he made. He is really upset by what has gone on, and he is also talking about, I remember when we were, we found somebody floating in the ocean, and they're talking about all this stuff, and he goes, you know, I have to undo what I just did. And you turn the page, and you see that the person they pulled out of the ocean was Bucky Barnes.
Huh.
So now I'm wondering, was Bucky, was the Winter Soldier not actually Bucky? This was because Namor's talking about pulling him out of the water, and Bucky ended up in the water right after the war, right after when he got blown up with when he thought they died. And he says, yep, you're very sneaky, Namor. Now do you have a plan? So that's how this ends. And then you're supposed to read Secret Empire 8, 9, and 10. But I thought this was a great way to end this and kind of get everything back together. I do kind of want to read issue 10 now. Where I've stayed away from it. Now there probably won't be any on the shelves. But I really, really like how they tied this all up. I saw a tweet by Nick Spencer that said, you know what, I want to thank everybody for being on the ride and thank you for all your support. And I wanted to say, why didn't you put P.S., all you idiots that gave me death threats, screw you. But I think that I wish that this story would have been able to be told the way they wanted it to, without any interference, without anything like that. Because I do think that it had a lot of really cool elements to it. It made Captain America interesting again. It made people guess as to what was going on. It's like a James Bond movie. You know he's going to get out of it, but how is he going to get out of it? That's right. What you're really waiting for and looking for.
I think the whole Secret Empire thing, and again, we could go down an entire rabbit hole of discussing, you know, the politics behind it. But as someone who's not reading Secret Empire, I think there's a couple things that have really affected how it's being received. Number one, this storyline was conceived almost certainly prior to the election that happened in November.
Yes.
So that, in a lot of people's minds, turned out a lot differently than they thought that it was going to.
Yep.
So imagine if Secret Empire was a storyline that was happening in a world where Hillary Clinton was president.
Yep.
Then it's this big what-if story, right? Whoa, what if this happened? What if we had – and then now I think for some people it is close enough to reality that it is not funny and it's not a what-if story. It's a what's happening story.
Yep.
And I think that is something that Marvel did not predict. And so where Marvel screwed up, and I think where Nick Spencer screwed up, and again, I have not been reading the story. I have been reading some of his responses to people around that kind of stuff, is that certain creators should not go on Twitter. And the problem I think that Nick Spencer has sometimes is the way that he responds to and really Marvel as a whole, the way that they respond to when people bring up a concern to them is in a very condescending
yep.
and dismissive way. And so when people say, given the state of the world today, do you really think turning the symbol of American patriotism into a Nazi was a good idea? And the response sometimes that comes back from Marvel is like, well, you don't know what you're talking about. Just wait till the end of the story and you'll figure it out.
Instead of dealing with the, oh my gosh, I know exactly how you feel.
Instead of being able to say like, hey, guys, yeah, this looks bad, right? I mean, we really would hope that you would stick around till the end of the story. But also, these storylines are planned out a very long time ahead of time.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to change course just because the events in the world have really changed around what the storyline was going to be. So please keep that in mind as you're reading this, or please, you know, try to keep an open mind as you're reading this. And I think that some of the stuff that they have said and that Spencer has said about the story, again, even going back to the ending of it, the things that were said by the creative team and by Marvel about people who were guessing this ending – that has basically happened as you're listening to the show. And I don't want to completely spoil it for people, but the ending turned out a lot like people thought that it was going to turn out. And there was adamant swearing of absolutely not. It's not this, and it's not this, and it's not going to be this, when it kind of is, you know, at the end of it. So I think that one of Marvel's biggest problems over the past few years is that of a PR problem. And whether that is Axel, you know, being in charge at this point, whether that is the current PR team that they have that are spinning stories and responding to the public, or whether it's that Marvel very freely lets their creators say whatever they want on social media, in a lot of ways, that has been their major problem. The story is, I mean, how much different is it from some of the other events that they've done over the past 3 years? Like, if there wasn't the political controversy around it, it would be just another mediocre Marvel event that has happened over the past few years. But in particular, it's a lot of their responses that have fueled the fire of the backlash against this event. And so now it has affected the entire direction of the company. And so as they go into this new generations and legacy and whatever they're calling all of this stuff moving forward – it'll be interesting to see how they engage with the fans, because I think that's where it's so interesting to me to see how the pendulum swings with the big two and their relationship with the fandom, right? And it's so much to me, like, as a hardcore gamer, it is very much to me like Microsoft and Sony. Like, in the previous generation of consoles, and I think I talked about this before, but you had the PlayStation 3. And when Sony came out and debuted the PlayStation 3, it was like $600. And their response to the fandom was like, hey, get a second job to pay for it.
Yeah.
It's that good. And people were like, nope. And Microsoft had come out and they were like, hey, man, we're all about gamers. We're all about connecting you with your friends. We're all about these exclusives that we have. We are the console for gamers. And in that generation, Microsoft surged out to this great lead. It ended up being close by the end of the generation, which was a very long one. But Microsoft really, from a PR standpoint, went very far ahead of Sony because they were perceived by people as being more friendly to gamers.
And that's what Marvel always used to be.
Correct, right?
Marvel always was that company.
And in DC, well, at least in the time that we've been doing this show, DC made a lot of PR fumbles, right? And they kind of struggled at times. But then with Rebirth and, you know, coming out of – getting away from New 52 and moving into Rebirth and Convergence and all that kind of stuff – there was a change in DC's relationship, or at least perception of their relationship with the fandom, right? Where it was kind of like people were like, hey, man, DC is making some really positive moves.
Yep.
And they're doing things in a way that, as a longtime fan of DC, makes me feel good about their relationship with me and what they're kind of doing. And I think that was the general response of the public to a lot of the stuff that DC was doing. And then you had Marvel, who had gotten very arrogant due to the success of their cinematic universe, and they kind of lost the connection with fans around their comics. And then they responded to that in a very Sony way from that PlayStation 3 generation, where they were very condescending to their fandom and very sort of almost confrontational in ways to their fandom.
Yep.
And so I think that then created a backlash where, much like when DC was in that hole, you can't do anything right. It doesn't matter what Marvel was trying. It doesn't matter what they were putting out there or what they were trying to do. It wasn't clicking with people because people were pissed at what Marvel had become in their eyes. And so now they kind of find themselves in this spot where, you know, there's some real dents in the armor that was Marvel's sort of empire that they had built up, no pun intended, over the past like 5 or 6 years or so. You just had – I was reading this morning how the Inhumans premiere that was premiering on IMAX and things like that. The first couple episodes of the Inhumans show have gotten terrible reviews. And they were being shown in IMAX theaters so that people could go and watch it as a movie to start. And the ticket sales were not good of that. And so they're kind of getting hit. The Defenders was kind of greeted with a lukewarm response, right? And you're coming off of a period of time where Wonder Woman is beloved. That movie just absolutely did gangbusters, right? Not that DC doesn't still have their problems with their cinematic universe, all this nonsense about Affleck and, you know, these standalone movies and all this kind of stuff. But I think overall, from a PR standpoint, it feels like DC has the upper hand now, and it feels like Marvel is struggling. And so it's just kind of fascinating to take a step back from the big two and see how that – what felt like a sure thing a few years ago has completely flipped back to the other side. And so, you know, the lesson continues to be, and it's the same in the video game universe, because this generation, Sony is killing Microsoft in sales and console sales and stuff like that. But if you would have asked that right before the launch of those two new consoles, the PS4 and the Xbox One, people would have told you Microsoft's going to continue to run away with it. Nope, because Microsoft got cocky and they stopped caring about what the fandom thought. And then boom, they fell. And so with these big two, like they have to have a better finger on the pulse of where their audience is at. And when they don't do that, they fall fast and they fall hard.
Yeah.
And that's where Marvel's at right now. So it's going to be interesting to see how they rebound in the coming months with this sort of soft relaunch that they're doing with that. But yeah, and I'll probably read Secret Empire at some point, maybe in trade or something when it's collected, or borrow the issues that you have or something like that. But again, outside of my favorite characters of Marvel, they haven't sold me on a big event company-wide in a while.
Yeah.
So interesting, interesting stuff. Well, we're going to hop over to the other member of the Big Two and talk about DC, because I have a short box of comics at home that I have been trying to catch up on. And one of the series that I was able to catch up on over the past week was Batman. I had about 7 issues of Batman that I needed to read. And so I am firmly in the middle of the War of Jokes and Riddles now, which I believe is a story that Batman is telling to Catwoman.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the framing device of that.
Did you notice that, like, you read the first issue? Because when I reviewed the first issue, it's very confusing for the first 3 or 4 what is going on.
Right.
But that is pretty much what it is. The two of them are...
And it seems like he makes a comment in here, and I could be wrong, so people can correct me if I am, but he's making a comment here. It sounds like he's telling the story of something that happened when he was early on in his Batman
career. It sounds like that's what it is.
Yeah. Like, it sounds like he... Because he mentions a thing about being, like, a year into it or something like that. But he's telling the story about the time when the Joker and the Riddler went to war. And it's an awesome story.
Yeah.
And of course, Tom King is writing it. And you have Michael Janin, who's doing the pencils, inks, and has a fantastic cover for issue number 28, which is the issue that I'm talking about. And of course, June Chung does the colors. Clayton Coles does the letters. And you have Jamie Rich doing the editing on this one. And I'm a big fan of Jamie Rich. So I did not know that he was editing Batman now, but that's pretty freaking awesome. So in the part of this story, what has happened is that the Joker and the Riddler have gone to war, and they have basically taken both parts of the city. And so you have I forget who has the east side and the west side. Oh, the Joker had captured most of Gotham's upper west side, and the Riddler had the east side. And so this book starts off with Commissioner Gordon going to visit each camp. And for one of them, he has to dress like a prisoner with a hood over his head. And for the other one, he basically has to strip down to his underpants. And so he goes and visits both sides to see what they want. And of course, they both want Batman. And so this is Batman telling the story about how he warned Gordon not to go. And he talked about how this wasn't going to be good if he went. And Gordon says, you know, a conversation that they always had between each other is one of them would say, the city has fallen before, but every time it falls, we catch it. And so this is what Gordon felt like he needed to do. He needed to go and meet with the Joker and meet with the Riddler and figure out what they wanted to do. And there's some great pages where you see him standing before each group, and they're basically, you know, sort of making their demands. And you see that the Riddler has his group of, you know, he's got Poison Ivy, and he's got Deathstroke, and he's got Clayface, and he's got Mr. Zazz, I believe, and he has Scarecrow and Killer Croc. And then you have the Joker, who's got Deadshot, and he's got the is it the Puppet Master?
Yes, the Ventriloquist.
The Ventriloquist. He's got the Ventriloquist, and he's got the Mad Hatter, and he's got Mr. Freeze, and so they each, and he's got Solomon Grundy, and so they each have their armies, and their armies have been tearing Gotham apart and basically destroying the entire city. And so Gordon is telling Batman, you know, both of them have the same demand, bring me the Batman and the war ends. And, you know, they're trying to figure out, like, what do we do from here? And Gordon is saying, I'm calling in the feds. Like, this is now, this war between the Riddler and the Joker is beyond us. I can't, we're not going to be able to handle this, just the two of us, because this, the city is at stake. You know, we have to basically bring the feds in. And if we have to take out the rest of these criminals, we don't, we can't have these guys adding any more people to their armies, because we're already in rough shape. And so Catwoman makes an appearance in this one, and there's sort of a little rendezvous that the two of them have, because Batman goes to see her to see which side that she's going to be on. And Catwoman is basically telling him, like, those guys are criminals. I'm not affiliated with either one of them. Meanwhile, she's robbing, you know, a mob boss's house as that's happening. But he really was, you know, going to make sure that she was safe. But my favorite part of this issue is that you have Deadshot, who was in the employ of the Joker, and you have Deathstroke, who is in the employ of the Riddler. And the two of them are overlooking the Gotham City PD. They're basically on both sides of the building waiting for the bat signal to go up so that when Batman shows up, they're going to snipe him. And the two of them are there. And when they notice that each other are there, the first thing they do is fire at one another. And they're such good marksmen that the bullets hit each other.
Yeah.
And so they can't kill each other that way. So over the next 5 days, the two of them battle each other across the city and are – like kill dozens and dozens of people. Buildings get blown up. The two of them are, you know, doing hand-to-hand combat in the street, throwing all different weapons at each other. And they're so evenly matched, which I thought was interesting, because maybe I don't know enough about Deadshot. I'm guessing that since the Suicide Squad movie, his stature and status in the DC universe has risen.
Yes.
To the point where I don't know that he was always considered to be kind of an equal of Deathstroke. In some ways, I felt like he was kind of like a shabby knockoff of Deathstroke.
It's exactly that. And that's what had happened.
But here, he is played up as someone who is the equal of Deathstroke. And the two of them are sort of battling to a standstill across the city. And Batman is chasing them across the city and trying to track them down. And he's like a step behind them everywhere. And so every time he gets to the place that they were fighting, he's finding dead bodies and he's finding people that he has to bring to safety. And so when he finally catches up with them 5 days later, and as he's narrating the story, and this is what I really like, that what you're getting from Tom King, and we've talked about this before, this sort of cerebral look at Batman, is you're getting to see the parts of him that are starting to crack. Right. And one of the things that's starting to crack about him as he's telling the story to Catwoman, where she has to ask him at one point, like, are you OK? Because he's telling her the story and he's getting so, when he gets to the point where he says, it took me 5 days to track these two down, 5 days and all these dead people, you can tell that by the time that he finally caught up with them, he was so furious and guilty and enraged and just full of emotion that he beats the crap out of both of them and beats Deadshot within like an inch of his life. They talk about him being in the hospital and having his whole orbital socket shattered and basically having swelling on his brain. And it's a miracle that he survived. And as the issue ends, you know, it ends with Gordon kind of telling Batman about the state of Deadshot when they got him to the hospital and the fact that it was a miracle that he survived. So you have Batman basically admitting to Catwoman as he's telling the story, and you're seeing that he's been pushed to the brink, that he literally almost killed Deadshot in trying to stop this war between the Joker and the Riddler. And so this whole, like, it feels like, and maybe I'm misinterpreting the timeline here, but it feels like a year one sort of tale where you're talking about the making of Batman and how this was an instance where when the Joker and the Riddler went head to head, it pushed Batman to the edge. And it's just, it's a great storyline. So if you haven't been reading Batman, or maybe you dropped off after the whole Bane storyline, like, as I've caught up on these most recent issues, I have really, really been digging this run on Batman.
He definitely is a writer of books. I mean, we know that with King, that that's what he's done.
Sure.
We also know that he has sort of a – was he in the CIA? Was that what his
– I believe so, yes.
And you can see how when he writes with a very large scope in mind. And he's got things, and it's something –
there's a lot of inner dialogue. There's a lot of background conversation and stuff, and I like that.
And I kind of struggle with things like that, so I've not really warmed up to a lot of his arc so far. But I am liking this one. Once I got clear of what exactly was going on, it's almost like he had the inside joke, I didn't. And he's like, oh, you're going to laugh. Trust me, you'll laugh at this one.
It reminds me of the period of time after One More Day when you had the classic villains of Spider-Man who were brought back for an event called the Gauntlet.
Mm-hmm.
And you had all of these different writers come in. And this is, of course, I will mention again, the Joe Kelly Rhino story. But what was great about those storylines, and you had Hammerhead, you had the Lizard, you had Doc Ock, you had all of these characters who had kind of been on the shelf for a while because they had become a joke.
Yep.
A lot of them had become just cannon fodder for other people's stories that weren't Spider-Man stories and stuff like that. So the classic villains went away for a while. And when they were brought back for the Gauntlet, they were brought back in the vein of, let's make these villains scary for Spider-Man again. And so each one of their storylines had the effect of really sort of getting in that villain's head and defining, why do they hate Spider-Man? Why are they so dangerous to Spider-Man? And that's kind of what you're also getting here with the Joker and the Riddler, is you're getting inside the villains' heads of like, why, you know, why do they hate Batman so much? But also, how does that affect their relationship with one another? And here with the Joker and the Riddler, you have two individuals who are convinced that they are supposed to be the one that kills Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole reason for this war. I am the one that gets to kill Batman. And so, to me, that's just super interesting.
And talk about an elevation of a character. The Riddler was never on the same level as Joker. However, with Gotham, he has been one of the main proponents in the entire series.
Well, and the thing is, like, with the Riddler, you have the ability, and again, not being a Batman historian or expert or anything, but to me, like, the Riddler is like a more stable version of the Joker.
Yes.
Whereas the Joker is agent of chaos, completely psychotic with flashes of brilliance. You have the Riddler, who is super genius, strategist, supervillain with flashes of insanity.
Yes.
So it's almost like they're a mirror image of one another, you know?
So you brought up the name Joe Kelly, one of our favorite people in the entire world.
Yes.
And you remember when Joe Kelly and drawing a blank on the Ariel Olivetti did Space Ghost.
Yes.
They did that 6-issue miniseries, which was amazing. So I saw that Space Ghost was coming out. I did not see Joe Kelly's name attached to it, but I did see Olivetti.
Oh,
and
nice.
I thought, you know what? I might have to give this a chance. And then I opened up and saw that it was Jeff Parker who was the writer. And I said, I am
sold
in on this one. But before we do, are you watching People of Earth?
I am not watching People of Earth, but I saw that advertisement on one of my books as well, and you have been saying that that's a very funny show.
Very funny show. You would get a kick out of it because it is about three races of aliens that have been watching the Earth for all these years, and there's a it's insanity. The cast, it's got a great ensemble cast. They just brought Toby in from The Office, who is a alien psycho killer.
Oh, nice.
So very, very, very good stuff. On TBS, you got to check it out. And it takes place on the outskirts of Poughkeepsie, New York. How much better can that be?
Oh, do they go to the Chance to watch local concert and stuff?
Not yet. No? Not yet.
Catch a Twisted Sister show?
There we go. So we are starting off this issue of Space Ghost. This is part of the Future Quest Presents banner. And you've got an alien ship that is stealing gravity from another ship. And it is their whole it's everything in this space station revolves around having these three canisters of this certain stuff. And if they don't, the gravity on the ship's going to go insane and they will all die. So these guys have taken it because they can steal it. And they look like three furry bat looking dudes, white furry bats is what their face looks like. And they're talking about, oh, we got the stuff. And when we get back there, we are going to sell it and we are going to make tons of money and nobody can stop us. And then all of a sudden, the ship comes to a dead stop and Space Ghost is standing on the top of the ship, the front of the ship. And they're all looking around. And then one of the guys goes, bring the forward cannon forward. He goes, got him in a sight, sir. And they said, fire whenever. Now, Space Ghost can phase in and out. So as they shoot, he phases And all of a sudden the aliens are like, oh man, we just annihilated Space Ghost. And the other one's like, yeah, but we just put a hole in the wing. So now the ship's flying out of control. He's like, I don't care. We've got this.
So worth it.
And then Space Ghost phases back and he shoots through the windshield of the spaceship. The atmosphere starts getting sucked out. The most boisterous ones of the aliens gets thrown forward. And as he did, Space Ghost puts his hand through the hole that he shot and then punches the dude right in the face. Gets on the ship. And then you've got the
so
two
like
other
a vacuum enabled punch.
Yes. And you've got the two pilots that are still sitting in their seats. And Space Ghost is telling them, I have a great idea. Let's take this stolen cargo back to where you took it from. And we are going to help these other people. And then he's saying, you know, school's out and I need to take off.
School's out forever.
So then you're thinking, what was he talking about with school's out? And then you turn the page and you got this great shot of the Herculoids. And the Herculoids are talking. Somebody is narrating about the spectacular planet Amzot, home of the most unique people in the entire system. You've got people. You've got something that's made out of granite. You've got all these things. And basically, it is a teacher explaining the whole mythos of the Herculoids. And, you know, talking about how there was a planet next door that wanted to have a battle and wanted to have a fight. But you had these people that came in and helped save the day. And she's almost giving you sort of the – and then there's another one that they show. But she's kind of giving you the whole Hanna-Barbera speech about this is what's going on. Uh-huh. And this is what's happening. And you see in the classroom, you see all these little dudes sitting on these little circles floating in space. And they're all different alien races. And somebody raises their hand and asks a question. And the question is, do you think that if Space Force had still existed, they could have saved the Quasmarians? Because they're talking about how everybody was unified into one thing and then it broke up. And the teacher is saying, you know, I don't want to speculate about alternate history, but, you know, you think it would have made a difference. And there's a lot of little nods and catches in here to the alternate history of the Future Quest series. You know, talking about all sorts of different things. And then you see that three of the students that are there being spoken to are the two young kids that are part of Space Ghost crew.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the monkey. And they're sitting there.
Gleek, right?
Gleek. No, that wasn't Gleep, was it?
I thought Gleek.
Gleek. Yes, I might be.
Yeah.
Or wasn't that?
You're thinking Gleep and Gloop, who are
that
from
was
the
Herculoids.
Herculoids. Yeah.
Who was the monkey from Super Friends? I think that's Gleek. I think so. But we'll find out sooner.
You know what? You keep talking, Matthew.
We might have to. So the two kids are just sitting there. And as they are done, the teacher's talking, they're kind of waiting for their ride, who ends up being Space Ghost. And they're walking away going, man, you know how hard it is not.
Is it Blip?
Blip. Thank you. Goes, man.
By the way, I didn't look that up yet. I'm looking it up now.
Oh,
but
good.
I think you're right. I think Space Ghost is.
It is Blip.
Blip.
But they're sitting there talking about how they could have easily just wiped out everything that these kids were saying and corrected everything that the teacher was saying. But they were afraid that if they did, they would mention that they were part of Space Ghost. They're part of his young assistant's crew and the new Space Force. And they didn't want anybody to know about that. So meanwhile, you got the kids that are waiting and they get in the ship and they start flying away. And they see some crazy adventures are going on, so they decide that they're going to do it. But before they do, they show – it's a brother and sister team. And they show – the boy says, oh, my gosh, I can't help but thinking about them right now. And you see it's a picture of their parents. And the sister's like, you know, they'd be terrified if they knew all the dangers that we were facing right now. But after the disaster that took them and nearly took us – and then they're like, I know, I know. And you see that Blip the monkey gives them a big
– Jan and Jace.
Jan and Jace.
Brother and sister.
And Blip. And they give them a big hug. So you see that, you know, they're talking about the fact that they literally work for Space Ghost and that they're happy with the way life is right now. But, of course, they miss their parents. And then you see Space Ghost, who is on in his little space lair. And as he's standing there, he hears voices. And then you see – and they do this in such a great black and white thing. And I'll show you, Brian, really quick. He starts seeing his base full of people,
uh-huh.
And you start realizing what he has lost in this whole thing. And it is all of them, and these guys are all joking around and arguing with each other about stuff and then getting a mission. And you're seeing that this is the life that he had before he became Space Ghost. And then the two kids show up with a monkey, and they're like, hey, you know, we caught the news wave about you on Rockstar. Great job. And they're like, oh, thanks a lot, Jace. But it doesn't look like it's enough. They've got an alien monster that is attacking a colony. And you see on the big screen this big Jack Kirby-esque looking monster destroying a planet. And they're like, so you know what? We need to get out there and go see what's going on. So they jump in their ship and they go to the planet of the Herculoids. And you see that the Herculoids are doing these sort of exercises. They've got like that dinosaur thing that shoots lava bolts out of its little horn. And they're teaching it accuracy, so it's shooting it free.
You know, people are screaming that we're not immediately remembering the names of all these
characters. I don't even know anybody in the Herculoids.
The Herculoids to me are Gleep Gloop, and I don't care who anybody else is.
Yep, and some
Gleep
humans.
And Gloop are the best.
So the father human guy who looks like Thundar the Barbarian is saying, oh, you know what? We've got to stop from collecting fruit because we have visitors. And you see Space Ghost and the kids show up, and they're all sitting around the campfire, all talking about what's going on right now and how they need to. They're looking for something that is going to help them. And he's saying, I'm looking for a place called Vokar Cavern. And they're like, oh, yeah, the Vokar Cavern. Well, it's the most dangerous place on the planet. And if you go in there, it's going to be very scary. And then he tells them that, you know, if you guys go in there, you might have to go in by yourself because we can't go in there with you. And then you see later on that all of them decide that they're going to go help. So now you're having a team up of Space Ghost, the teens, and the Herculoids. And as they start walking in, you see somebody in there outside in this cave that they're going in there going, oh, someone's trying to find the weapons in here so they can help defeat. And he goes, well, you're going to have to fight Metallus. And you see this purple-looking monster dude waiting for them to show up. So fun book. I love the Space Ghost series that Joe Kelly and Oliver Olivetti put out. I love the whole look of it. I love the feel. And this is looking to be the same thing. It is a – oh, it might be an ongoing because it doesn't have of six. So if this is an ongoing series, I'll definitely be picking up because I loved it.
All right, Matthew. Well, those are our new books for this week. Now it is time to get back into the Summer of Dread. We are almost through the complete Case Files of Judge Dread Volume 1. And the couple storylines that we're going to focus on today, one of them is sort of a one-shot while the other one is sort of a multi-issue storyline, and it's one of the sillier ones, I think, in the Judge Dredd ones, although that's who's to say which one is the actual silliest one. We are, of course, talking about the Elvis storyline, or as I like to refer to it, the Killer Car Saga. Because you have, as you start off, Dave Patton loved his car. He had saved for 10 years to buy him and had chosen the personality himself. So we're already seeing here that you have cars who are embedded with a personality.
And so, we are still on the moon, by the way.
We are still on the moon. In fact, this is kind of getting toward the end of Judge Dredd's time on the moon, but not before we have one last final sort of saga here. And what you have is this guy who completely loves his car. It's like a Knight Rider scenario.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This guy's the Michael Knight to
almost
his,
looks like him.
He does look a little bit like Hasselhoff. And so rather than, you know, let the car repair itself and things like that, this guy loves his car so much that he likes to work on the car himself, even though he doesn't really need to do that in this day and age because the technology that powers these cars, you know, there are better ways to do that stuff. But he's a hands-on guy. And so you have the car saying, hey, Dad, you know, I can do my own repairs. And he's saying, I know. But the man at the garage says it's the only way to get to know your own car is to really do the repairs yourself. So he decides that he's going to do his repairs, but he makes a mistake and he sort of drops his wrench as he's working on the car, and it dings the part of the car that is in charge of the car's personality. And he's like, oh, sorry. And he calls his car Elvis. Oh, I'm sorry, Elvis. I didn't mean to hurt you. And the car's like, yeah, you did, Dad, but what the heck? Jump in. I'm getting sick of sitting in this stupid garage. And he gets in the car. And as soon as Dave is telling the car, well, let's do this or this, the car says, I know it's an order, but I don't feel like obeying you right now. And you're seeing that whatever damage he did to the car basically screwed up the car's personality, so it has no impulse control, and now it does whatever it wants to do. And what it wants to do is kind of destroy stuff.
Just drive real fast, knock things over.
Yep, because it has the personality of a child. So imagine a child who has no rules and no restrictions or no anything else. And anytime an adult tells the child what to do, he rebels against it. And so he ends up using his mechanical arms to almost strangle Dave and then shoots him out the ejector seat. And this guy, you know, is essentially broken and beaten, and then the car takes off by itself. And when Judge Dredd happens upon this guy, he literally dies in Dredd's arms. And so now you have Dredd saying, we've got a killer car on the loose. We need to get the rest of the judges and get out here and get these guys. Now, the car has decided that it's going to go to a parking garage, and it is going to similarly disable the impulse control and alter the personalities of other intelligent cars in the garage. So right away, you have Elvis, who is starting to build an army of cars that think just like he does.
And the little scary claws that come out of every one of them are kind of creepy.
They have mechanical arms. Yep. They're, you know, they're able to change the atmosphere inside the cockpit and stuff like that. And so as this first storyline ends, you have Dredd saying, you know, we got to get everybody together. And one of the judges saying, you know, this car's on the floor somewhere and he's got a bunch of buddies with him. And you see that there's a whole army of these cars now that are coming after the judges. And so when we get into the second part of the storyline, not only do you have Elvis, who is the leader of these rogue cars now, but you have a whole bunch of other cars that are basically attacking the judges. And so they are just making mincemeat out of the judges, just gunning them down, using the weapons and tools that some of the cars have built into them.
Squishing them.
Yeah, there's construction machines. They're just completely destroying these judges and running right through them. And the cars are joking to each other as they are taking out all of the judges. And so back at I forget who the name of the Texas judge.
Yeah,
is, the sort of
he's like the sheriff.
Yeah, the sheriff is. I forget, but he's telling, you know, Dredd, there's a bunch more of these cars on the way, because Dredd is basically saying, you know, we have to get like corrosive acid to take these things down. That's the only way we're going to stop these cars. Meanwhile, you have the cars who are going to what amounts to a local mall and are rampaging through the mall, running over people that are shopping and
just
sort
like
of,
the Blues Brothers.
Yep. Except for the Blues Brothers, it was mostly property damage.
Yes, this is
here. It's mostly carnage. But the judges figure out that if they arm themselves with corrosive acid, they can basically spray down the cars and it will stop the cars in their tracks. And they're able to do that. But when they take out all of these cars, you still have Elvis that gets away. And this is where the story, if it wasn't crazy enough already, as you get into the third installment of this story, you now have the car of Elvis, who has broken into an apartment building and like speed buggy is going up the back stairwell talking to itself about how it's going to hide and stuff like that. So you've got this couple who is watching the events on the news. They're kind of reading the nightly paper, and in the background, the news is playing about how all of these judges are dead and all of this bad stuff has happened because of this killer car. And all of a sudden there's a knock on the door, and it reminded me of the Candygram Saturday Night Live, the land shark, you know, sort of thing. Because of course, when they open their front door, there is a killer car that was the one knocking on the door, and the car comes in, and the car's like, I'm going to kill the two of you unless you let me hide out here and do what I need to do until all of this blows over. And so as the couple is being held hostage, they're watching this car who is literally playing with children's
toys. Like you said, it's like the mind of a child, because it's got this the toy soldiers, blocks, an airplane.
And the husband's saying, this is crazy. It's playing with all of the toys like it was just a little kid. And you're seeing that that's basically what this car is. And so you have the car who is now holding them hostage, and Dredd knows the only way that he's going to be able to fight this thing is to lure it out, because he has no idea where this car's hiding. Yep. So he sort of gets on the television and he's basically saying, you know, we'll catch the car soon. Frankly, this Elvis is chicken. It's afraid to come out and fight me because it knows that I'm too smart for it. Because Dredd has already figured out that this car has sort of the personality of an impulsive kid. And so, of course, the car is offended by that, and the car decides that it's going to basically answer Judge Dredd's challenge, but it doesn't show up where Dredd has tried to lure this car to. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, it shows up at Dredd's house instead.
Yep.
So Dredd goes home and he opens the door to his house to find that Walter, you know, his robot, is being taken captive.
All tied up.
And Robert's like, it came in through the service list, the service lift. I tried to grapple with him, but he was too strong. And so the car is going to kill Dredd. And as we go into the final installment, which I believe is the art on this one is Ian Gibson, because it's definitely a different look than it was before. But in the fourth part of this story, the car takes Judge Dredd hostage and puts him in the cockpit and basically says, I'm going to take over this whole city now because no one's going to want me to kill Judge Dredd. So I'm going to go out and we're going to have a parade for me. There's going to be a parade on the street. I want everybody to get out here. I want floats made. And I'm going to have Judge Dredd in my cockpit and I will freeze him to death with my AC system if you don't do what I want to do. And so you have Dredd, who is basically semi-conscious in this car and being paraded through the streets as a hostage as Elvis is making the whole entire city throw a parade for himself. And so what Dredd decides to do is he is going to get a message to the other judges about what he thinks they can do to take down Elvis. And so he breathes on the glass and he uses Dredd's message was the secret judge's code using only three lines and two dots. So with three lines and two dots, he uses this sort of judge's version of Morse code to send a message to the rest of the judges to have autograph seekers show up at the car when they get to the end of the parade.
Because – and it is a riot when you see this. Everybody's – you know, it's like – it was like Elvis. You know, it's like there's floats with his name everywhere.
Sure.
There's all sorts of stuff. Yeah. And then when the autograph seekers come running up and they're all singing praises to his name and he's all excited about it. And he's like, oh, you want my autograph? You want my autograph? And yeah, it got crazy.
So as the autograph seekers show up like Judge Dredd had requested that they do, of course, Elvis is thinking, wow, look, I've got all these fans. Of course I'll sign autographs. And so he's using his mechanical arms to sign autographs. Now, Dredd happens to find inside the car that he's being held captive in, a chemistry set that the car was playing with. So he decides to use the chemistry set to start a fire in the cockpit of the car, which of course then causes the car to have to eject him so that it can put out the fire because he's burning from the inside.
Yep.
And when he does that, the other judges were waiting there with the corrosive acid guns and they end up basically destroying this car. And you have – I think it's Judge Tex, if I'm not mistaken. I think that's who it is. It says, just a pile of dust on the studio floor now. All that's left of a car who never grew up. And Dredd says, but it would have been better for us if he'd never been born.
Yep.
And that's the way the story ends. So the saga ends with the car being melted. And that was a four-part storyline. And then right after that, we go into a story that has art by Brian Bolland.
Yes.
And it is written by John Howard. And it is called Oxygen Board. The year is 2100. Each day, huge astro tankers arrive at docking bays above the domes that cover Luna F. Their cargo, oxygen. So we're still on the moon, and you have these oxygen tankers that show up to pump oxygen into the domes and the buildings that all the people are living in on the moon. And right in the beginning of this one, you have basically a heist going down where these robbers come in, and instead of pumping oxygen into the dome, they pump tranquilizer gas into the dome and essentially put everyone to sleep. And then when they do that, they are free to loot the entire city as they see fit. But of course, when you put everyone to sleep in a city where there are cars being driven on the highway, there are trains going on, there are people operating machinery, bad things to start to happen.
Yeah, of course, they explain the funny thing in here saying about how, you know, just because all the people are gone doesn't mean the machines have stopped.
Right. And now the machines in some cases can't stop because they are out of control. And so the judges, of course, have their own masks that they wear that filter out the tranquilizer so that they're not affected by this. But pretty much all of the citizenry is. And so things are going completely crazy. And the guys who were the ones behind this, when the judges come around looking for whoever's doing this, they just pretend that they're asleep.
Yep.
They pretend that they got knocked out by the gas too. But what you end up seeing is that they have a whole apartment full of loot now that they've gone through the whole city and looted. So once the judges end up getting the oxygen restored and people wake up and they start to take care of some of the damage and stuff like this, you've got the guys that pulled off the heist who are back at their apartment saying, holy crap, we're rich. Look at all of this loot. They're going through it. And it's like Scrooge McDuck piles of gold all over the place. And as they're sitting there, all of a sudden there's a knock at the door and they're like, holy crap, what's going on? And they turn on the video screen and there is a robot there saying, good afternoon, Mr. Smith. I'm your payment control robot at the oxygen board. I've been trying to reach you all day. And the guy who's the lead robber is like, oh, I've been out on a job. And the robot says, it's come to my attention that your oxygen bill is now 2 months overdue. So I'm afraid I'm going to have to terminate your supply. And he's like, what do you mean? You can't cut me off. And all of a sudden, the robot says, so we're sucking all the oxygen out of your apartment because you haven't paid your oxygen bill. And these guys are looking for the key to get out of the apartment, but they dropped it somewhere in the loot that they have. And they can't find it. So all of these four robbers who started this story by basically robbing the oxygen of people in the city end up suffocating on a pile of their own loot because they didn't pay their oxygen bill.
Yep.
And at the end, Dredd says, Judge Tex. He says, well, I guess we got them trank gas raiders after all, Marshall. The oxygen board executed them for us. And he says, not executed, Tex, cut off. It sure pays to keep your gas bills up to date.
And you also have the old Luna saying, because everybody knows that old Luna saying, that a simple man can beat the law, but baby, only a fool bucks the oxygen board.
Yep.
Because that's everybody knows that you say that up on the moon.
And that is the way that particular story ends. Now, we are almost to the end of this entire volume of Judge Dredd case files. So your homework, which is not going to be for the next episode, but for the one after, is going to be to read the jumper story, which is the next one, through the bonus material in the book. So finish off the book for the next installment, which will be the final installment of our Summer of Dredd summer reading project. Of course, we still have to watch Dredd, the movie from a few years ago, as our final installment of the summer watching project. So we've got a couple installments of the summer project left, but read that stuff for the next installment of that. That is going to wrap up this episode of the Secret Identity podcast, Matthew Herring. So for you,
yes,
and for me, have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.